there, Dr. B here with your Module 6 clarifying lecture. As I was making this today, I realized that I actually put Module 6 in the header of the Module 5 clarifying lecture, and this is actually Module 6. So this is the real Module 6 clarifying lecture. General announcements, remember to upload any quality point reviews you're doing to Blackboard where it says upload here for quality points. Don't just post them on the Q&A board. That's great, but you won't get your quality points that way. You have to submit them for quality points. Your videos of your researcher are due in Module 7. Make sure that you're making a video where you're visible and you have your PowerPoint visible. Voiced over PowerPoints are not acceptable. They have to be videos. So what you want to do if you are a little shaky about that, make sure that you're contacting the Personal Support Center for guidance. I see that many of you are taking advantage of the quality points, and that's great. I'm glad to see that. And a lot of you are using the Science of Behavior tutorials, getting a lot of good feedback on that. So that's fantastic. I'm glad that you're using those. All right, let's talk a little bit about the inner teaching. Make sure that you're using the terms, okay? I'm going to talk a little bit about the terms this week and what I was looking for, but make sure that you're using the terms because the terms are very important. Make sure that you're avoiding those explanatory fictions like know and understand. I know Skinner is talking about knowing and understanding this week, but remember that when we're talking about knowing, we have to crawl into somebody else's head to confirm that. And when you have to crawl into somebody else's head to confirm something, that's an explanatory fiction. Okay, so make sure that you are avoiding those types of things and that you're sticking to observable, measurable things. So let's talk about the first question. Why is generalization often left off plans? And it's nice to see that a lot of you who are working in the autism field were like, what do you mean? Generalizations left off plans. It's nice to see that that's happening because that's not how it always was. So it's nice to see that that's changing and that the tide's changing there. I find that some of you say, and some of you have talked about, that the focus is often more on acquisition than it is generalization and maintenance. It's much more reinforcing when we're talking about acquisition. You know, new novel skills being displayed is often, you know, way more reinforcing to the teacher. Depending on the environment, reinforcement might be forthcoming from a supervisor or from, you know, the insurance company, or it might be from, you know, other outside sources, and that might be a reason why there's not as much of a focus on generalization and maintenance. It's easy to forget that generalization and maintenance take work and they're not automatic, that there really is a use it or lose it type of thing to generalization and maintenance, that just because you can do it in one place doesn't mean that you can use it in another. It can be a pain, you know, going out in the community, getting the coat on, the stimuli is not there, I got to pack it up, some administrations may not, you know, if, for lack of a better term, see the value of it, you know. I remember talking to administrators, oh, you know, it's too expensive, we got to hire a bus, there's more insurance, you know, we're off site now, and all this stuff. Can't we just do it here? And so it can be a bigger response effort. So that can be sometimes a reason why generalization and maintenance are left off plans. And sometimes that's why you see that kind of left off. But again, use it or lose it. Does this just apply to kids with autism? No. You know, we always talk about, you know, kids with autism, kids with autism, kids with autism. But honestly, I see this even with ABA students, like the students in this certificate program, that if you don't work at it and you don't practice and you don't go back to those Quizlets later on, especially with the gap between 619 and 623, because 621, you're really looking at different things, that I see a lot of students who sometimes the things that are learned here don't generalize to 623, and we have to do some reviews. And there are some review things that we have in place in 623, but I can tell you that it is worth your time to go and review those Quizlets during the 8 weeks that 621 is going on, and make sure that you're still fluent and that you're still using those terms, because again, it's a, you know, you're going to have to generalize those skills to a now more applied environment. And, you know, it, a lot of times we don't realize how important these things are to generalizing. So, you know, I've had some students that have been stuck in those ways. I remember getting a call from a mom who was in tears, convinced that her child had regressed. Oh my gosh, my kid regressed. Like, well, wait a minute. Before you get too worked up about this, let me go in and see what's going on. Well, it turns out that it wasn't that the child had regressed. It was that the teacher was using different SDs to evoke the response. So because the other teacher had used the same SD over and over and over again, and this teacher was using a different SD, the child was not responding correctly to these new SDs. It was never programmed for generalization. So it really wasn't that the child regressed. It was that the child had never learned the repertoire. So we really do have to program for generalization and maintenance. And can you tell generalization was the topic of my dissertation? But yeah, it really is important. So why would the vacuum be an issue? Pretty much every term I get responses like, you know, it's an issue with follow through, or it's an issue with reinforcement. And I will tell you that that's not it. And it's not a question of that they're not strict enough or it's a bad teacher. Because in fact, being too strict can hinder generalization. Because remember that one of the things that we do with generalization is we train loosely. We start to let go some of the structure in order to allow the behavior to generalize. So let's take it back to maybe sequential modification or maybe multiple exemplars. So let's think about the different types of vacuums. Walk through a target. You've got upright vacuums, you've got shark vacuums, you've got Dyson vacuums, you have stick vacuums, you have canister vacuums, you have old-fashioned vacuums, you have ones with bags, you have bagless vacuums. Switches are in different places. So if the child or the adult learns to vacuum on one specific vacuum, and then they're presented with a vacuum that has all these different stimuli that are not the same as this vacuum, that may completely explain why they're not responding correctly. Now, for a typical person who's shown a new vacuum where, you know, buttons are in a different place, or maybe there's a new type of, you know, gadget that's attached to it, we start going, well, what is this? I don't know what this is. How do you turn this on again? I have no idea. What am I doing here? And maybe, you know, certain people will say, I don't do newfangled gadgets. Give me my old one back. Whereas maybe someone who doesn't communicate in the same way might have a meltdown, or they might just sit and stare. But it's the same idea that behavior hasn't generalized to that new environment. What if the prompts in the SDs were too structured? Again, bringing it back to my student that every single time they were asked to do the same task, the same SD was presented. And I think about my doc advisor. He tells the story of one of his students that was learning to respond to, what's your name? So, what's your name? Jimmy. Fantastic. Gets in the classroom. 10 out of 10. Okay, we're ready to generalize. Monday, what's your name? Jimmy. Great. All right, we're going to go across the hall. What's your name? Jimmy. Fantastic. 10 out of 10. All right, we're going to go to a novel classroom. What's your name? Jimmy. 10 out of 10. Fantastic. Media center. What's your name? We're on a roll. Okay, cafeteria. Again on a roll. Principal's office. We're like at 50 out of 50 here. And then we get to the bus driver and they go, so who are you? No response. Because it wasn't what's your name. Jimmy wasn't taught that exemplar. That's the difference, okay? So that's where it is. It's not that it was bad teaching. It was that that exemplar wasn't taught. So how many exemplars do you teach? Well, there really isn't a, okay, you have to teach 20 exemplars and then it generalizes. It's not that cut and dried. It's more that when you get to a point where somebody can respond to a novel stimulus without teaching, then you know you've trained sufficient exemplars. So it's really kind of a teach, test, teach, test, teach, test type of idea. So same idea with the pig and the cow thing. You want to make sure that you're training enough exemplars. And what's the difference between exemplars and examples? So examples would be more kind of, they wouldn't be members of the class. So exemplars are making sure that you're training enough members of the class so that when they're presented with a novel member of the class, that they can then respond appropriately. So, you know, you see this all the time, that, again, it's very reinforcing for a student to respond appropriately. So if my student is responding really well to this pig, this horse, this cow, you can see why somebody might stick with it if they aren't trained in generalization and maintenance. Because if I'm not trained in generalization and maintenance, then I might see it as, well, you're not getting my kid versus I need to teach a little bit differently. And you can, I think I could get that as, you know, a parent or an RBT or something like that if I haven't been trained in that way. Also, keep in mind that no is an explanatory fiction, right? That person knows a pig, knows a horse, knows a cow. Again, I'd have to crawl into their head to measure that. And what would no mean? I don't, could be anything, right? It's better to say that they are responding with the word pig when I present a picture of a pig, and that they can respond to all kinds of different pictures. That's where that multiple exemplar comes in. Now, can you train up every single picture or, pig in the world? No, it would be physically impossible to do that. Or every single class that pig could ever show up in? No, it's not possible. That's why you use multiple exemplar training. You train up enough so that when others show up, that child or adult can say, oh yeah, that's a pig. Okay. Now let's get to the Monopoly money one. Because most of you got the idea that the Monopoly money was kind of a bad idea, but some of you thought, okay, well, you could start with it. But that's kind of an unnecessary step. Why would you start with that? Because then you have to fade it, and then you've got to add in the real money. Or why not just start with the real stuff to begin with, right? And what's that called? That's called programming common stimuli. So, you know, oh, it's expensive to do that or whatever. Or, you know, I worked in a high school where, you know, it wasn't in the greatest of areas. And, you know, we had a safe with real money and we used it. And honestly, we never had a problem. So it's possible to do. You can use real money to teach money skills. And, you know, again, when you're thinking about programming common stimuli, and I just saw a blog on this in the I Love ABA blog, you know, blogs to follow. This one's a good one, where the author, she was talking about teaching to the environments that the students are in and to the skills the students need. So unless the student is in a family where they're avid Monopoly players or there's a lot of game nights that go on and they're going to be playing Monopoly a lot, then why not use the common stimuli that are going to be used in their environment? Same thing with tying shoes. Why not have the student tie actual shoes on their feet? Then you don't have to have them generalized from the shoe tying board to the shoes, programming common stimuli. When it comes to, you know, finding clothing items, and I made this mistake myself, you know, when I started teaching, I was like, oh, I'm going to, you know, go to the school store and I'm going to make these stimuli and they're going to be beautiful and all that kind of stuff. And I'm like, and they're cutting corners because they're just going to the dollar store and they're buying a bottle of shampoo and they're buying this and they're buying that. And it's just, you know, and I'm making these beautiful matching folders and all that kind of stuff when, no, they weren't cutting corners. Programming common stimuli makes a heck of a lot more sense because I was actually creating extra steps and extra work for absolutely nothing. Okay. Make sure that you're teaching to generalize to the environments the students are in and to the skills that the students are going to need, either in the environment they are in now or also in the environments that they're going to be in the future. You know, it seems like kind of quote unquote common sense, but we miss that a lot. All right, so let's talk about Skinner. And actually this will be kind of short, I think, because there were no questions this week. Almost always everybody says Skinner's a tough read. And I probably should have said this way earlier than I did. But I am now, you know, module 6. Thanks, you know, Dr. B. But the way that I read Skinner is the same way that I read, you know, like Sinclair Lewis and Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, because he is of that, you know, that generation, that early 20th century kind of writing. You know, if you read like For Whom the Bell Tolls or, you know, Main Street or any of that type of stuff, it's very flowery writing that kind of, you know, goes in these kind of circles and ellipses and things like that. And if you read it very much in that genre, it makes it a whole lot easier to read. Some people find that reading Skinner in an audiobook also makes it a lot easier to read. So what's Skinner trying to say? Let's boil it down a little bit, if I can. Basically, personality is just, it's a repertoire of behaviors. And it's the things we do in the reinforcers that maintain them. That's all it is. That's our personality. Our personality is the things that we do and the reinforcers that maintain them. And everybody's things that they do are different and everybody's reinforcers are different. There's nobody who has the same set of reinforcers. We might have similar sets. We might have similar repertoires, but nobody has the same set. And the longer those behaviors have been reinforced, the more set they are, the harder they are to change. the less frequently those behaviors are reinforced, the more set they are, the harder they are to change. So, you know, you think about like, you know, older people, it's like, oh gosh, they're really set in their ways. And most of the time we think about that cognitively, but think about it from a more behavioral perspective. It's like, well, these behaviors have been reinforced for a long time. And now that, you know, if you think about some of those behaviors, like using a slide rule, you know, how often has that stuff been reinforced, or writing a check even? You know, how often is that behavior reinforced? You know, it's actually making it harder to change those behaviors because it's not being reinforced very often. So that's what personality is. It's just our repertoire of how we do things and how they're reinforced. So what about this thing with self-management? It's a really sticky subject. You know, can we manage ourselves? You know, how do we quote unquote know ourselves? Obviously, we have to behave in certain ways, the contact reinforcement, and, you know, we kind of have to maximize our reinforcement contingencies. You know, that's kind of what we do as an animal on this earth. And, you know, some of us do it more on the surface, and some of us maybe, you know, don't have as many words to talk about it. And one person was talking about the fact that they have to make it a bit more explicit because they have a traumatic brain injury. And I do too. And I also have some genetic disorders. So what self-management really is, it's not so much cognitive strategies, although people really do talk about it as cognitive strategies, and there's a big body of literature like that. But if you look at it from a behavioral perspective, it's really a combo of, remember we talked about rule governance and how, you know, sometimes rules can have an effect on our behavior, those things that serve as stimuli that state what the reinforcers are going to be that we don't have to come in contact with, reinforcement and punishment. So, for example, I have a Google Calendar. It pretty much runs my life. My to-do list is embedded into the Google Calendar. My Google Calendar is color-coded. My breaks are embedded into my Google Calendar. When I'm going to do stuff is chunked into my Google Calendar. Other people are attached to my Google Calendar. There are files attached to my Google Calendar. There are due dates on my task list that are attached to my Google Calendar. Did I say Google enough? I have probably attended and downloaded enough books on time management and, you know, organizing to, you know, satisfy a small army, productive flourishing, Megan McIntosh, getting things done, all these types of things. And then talking about outside forces, I even have a coach that I have, that I've hired. So what do all these things do? Because one of the things that you need to realize, you know, we can self-manage, right? All these contingencies, but can you self-reinforce? Am I reinforcing my own behavior? And the answer is not really. Okay, Dr. B, you just talked yourself into a circle, right? No. What I'm doing is that I'm creating chains of behavior when I self-manage. So I'm creating that I do this, then I do that, then I do this, then I do that. And some of it may be quite reinforcing. Reinforcers come along the way, but that doesn't mean that I reinforced my own behavior. Okay? I set up chains of responding that maximize the environment reinforcing my behavior. Okay? And this is why changing your own behavior is so hard. And I'm going to give you an example in just a second about why this is what we're talking about here. So let's say you know, I'm doing this stuff. So I have the Google Calendar. I have the to-do list embedded into the Google Calendar. I have these time management webinars. I'm attending all this stuff. Am I reinforcing my own behavior by doing that? No. So when I click off, you know, the to-do list, that may be reinforcing, but I'm not reinforcing my own behavior by doing that. The environment is providing the reinforcement. When I get things done on time, the environment is providing either the positive reinforcement of somebody saying, thank you for getting that in on time, or the negative reinforcement of avoiding someone sending me the gentle reminder or the not so gentle reminder. Or I get the bill on time, I avoid the late fee. When I set up these patterns of behavior that I can do this and that I can do, excuse me, that I can do this and that I can do this and I can do this, then I can schedule other activities. And some of those activities may be more reinforcing in nature. So for example, I can, you know, get my work done on a regular basis, which means I might have more time to maybe watch Ghost Hunters, which is kind of my favorite show. Those types of things. I'm not reinforcing myself. I'm not reinforcing my own behavior. I'm setting up contingencies to make reinforcement more plentiful. Hopefully that makes sense. I know it's a really subtle distinction. And if you need more on that, just ask me and I'll keep trying to give you more examples there. The other thing about it is that talking about our private events or assuming anything about our private events is really difficult because contingencies can get in the way of us seeing the honest picture. You know, is it that we know ourselves or is it that we've learned to talk about ourselves based on reinforcement? So, you know, let's say for us, reading in a room is highly reinforcing. And someone said, oh, yeah, she's an introvert. And now all of a sudden we keep saying, yeah, I'm an introvert. And we start engaging in different behaviors that were supposedly, quote unquote, introverted. And then someone said, yeah, she hates to people. Oh, yeah, that's a great example. Oh, I hate to people. Yeah. You know, is it really that, you know, is there something in you that's really introverted? Or is it that you've learned to talk about it that way? And in psychoanalysis, the idea is that the more you talk about yourself, the more you know yourself. But is that really true? Is it even more just more of an explanatory fiction and kind of a never-ending cycle? I saw an interesting article on Facebook about self-help gurus. And how a lot of times they'll use like a modicum of science to kind of promote some BS. And it's really interesting. What they were saying was like, yes, there's fMRIs that say that certain parts of the brain light up when, you know, we say certain things or we look at certain things or experience certain things. But then people will say, oh, well, when we feel this, the brain does this. And that's too much of a stretch. Because there's no way to know how somebody really feels. There's no way to know if I say my throat hurts, that my throat hurts the same way your throat hurts. No way to know. We can see the irritation, we can see how the nerves work, we can see all that type of stuff. But my sensation is completely my own, and there's no way for you to experience it. And that's the thing about all this behaviorism. That's where it gets tricky. So we can figure out what reinforces and punishes our own behavior, and we can start setting up behavior chains that maximize those reinforcers, but we can't necessarily reinforce our own behavior. The environment does that. That's our take home. And that this arrangement that maximizes reinforcers and punishers basically is what we are. That's what Skinner's trying to say. So hopefully that's the take home message that you're hearing as well. All right. Well, hopefully that made a little bit more sense. I know that this is really tricky stuff. So thank you so much for watching and listening, and we'll see you in Module 7. You're almost there. Keep up the good work. No post-reinforcement pauses.